Afternoon. Today is Monday, July 11th, 2011. I'm Martin Lemlin, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, it's 5:02. My name is Martin Lemlin, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Today we're going to talk about some struggles that the Gay Pride Parade are having this year, as well as the health of Canada's media, and sort of their, not their involvement, but their intentions, and who they're really serving. CRTC regulations, a refugee camp in Africa that's getting a lot of attention finally, as well as a few HST ballot difficulties. But first, we're going to give things over to Free Speech Radio News for their headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert with these headlines. In Syria, pro-government demonstrators stormed the U.S. and French embassies today with what consular officials are describing as battering rams. Guards at the French embassy reportedly used live ammunition to repel the protests. Officials with both governments attacked Syria for failing to provide any protection from the protesters. They also repeated their condemnations of Syria's often bloody repression of anti-government protests. Human rights groups estimate the government crackdown has killed over 1,400 civilians in Syria. But the protests continue. That's a YouTube video of thousands of people protesting in what the video post says is the eastern city of Deir al-Zor. Meanwhile, in the city of Homs, Syrian forces firing a heavy machine gun reportedly killed one civilian and wounded 20 others. Human rights groups say house-to-house arrests continued in Hama. President Bashar al-Assad has called for talks on reforms, but Syria's opposition has refused to attend a two-day conference in the capital this week, saying it's futile as long as the violence continues. French officials have denied allegations that France is in direct peace talks with the government of Libya. Libya's Western-backed rebels have refused to hold talks while Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi remains in office. Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam told an Algerian newspaper that his government is negotiating directly with the French government, which has been arming Libya's rebels and playing a lead role in NATO airstrikes against Gaddafi's forces. French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé denied any such talks were taking place and reiterated that Gaddafi would have to leave office as part of any peace deal. In Japan, Prime Minister Naoto Kan has come forward with more details about what it will take to restart the nation's nuclear power plants. As recently as last week, Kan's administration maintained some of the country's closed reactors were safe to begin operating again. But now, after strong public protest, he's insisting that all the country's reactors will have to undergo stringent tsunami tolerance tests before reopening. Claudia Craig has more.
Kan's latest about-face is a blow to Japan's nuclear industry operators who want all plants reactivated as soon as possible. Under newly issued standards, all plants will have to be capable of withstanding a 9.0 scale earthquake and a 50-foot tsunami, test levels that may keep some plants closed indefinitely. All Japanese plants will also have to go through a series of simulations called stress tests, and it's unclear how long the process will take. Japanese consumers are already facing 15% power cutbacks. Only 19 of the country's 54 nuclear reactors have kept running in the wake of the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown. More will be shut down for maintenance soon. That means the Japanese government must address a scenario where every single one of the country's nuclear reactors is out of action by next April. The heightened concern over public safety comes amid continuing, almost daily news of further radioactive contamination in Japan's food and water supply from the Fukushima accident. Officials have detected radioactive cesium at levels about 3 to 6 times what the government considers safe in cattle feed and water. And just yesterday, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake triggered a small tsunami, which resulted in little physical damage but jarred the population's already frayed nerves. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
Shuttle diplomacy on the Arabian Peninsula this week. White House counterterrorism chief John Brennan has met with Yemen's vice president in what U.S. officials are describing as a bid to revive a deal for transferring power. Vice President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi has headed Yemen's government since President Ali Abdullah Saleh left the country to get treated for wounds he suffered in an attack on his compound. The transfer deal would reportedly give President Saleh immunity from prosecution in return for handing over power to his vice president, with the expectation that new national elections be held within 2 months. Saleh has balked at signing the deal, and many anti-government protesters have attacked it as well, insisting that Saleh must step down immediately and unconditionally. Finally, newly installed U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is on his first tour of Iraq. During a meeting with U.S. troops there, he told them, quote, "The reason you guys are here is because on 9/11, the United States got attacked." He also said he was very concerned about Iran and the weapons they are providing to extremists here in Iraq, and he threatened to act unilaterally if the Iraqi government did not fix the problem. Panetta is meeting with Iraqi officials on this trip, presumably to press for a decision on whether they will extend the deadline for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks to FSRN for those headlines. If you want to go and check out their whole newscast or different segments, you can do so at fsrn.org. Put out some fine things. And now for our local headlines. In local news, garbage pickup could be taking a backseat to compost. It's going before council. A report is coming before city council this week that recommends garbage collection be moved to once every 2 weeks, and they would expand curbside compost pickup to a weekly basis. Now, many municipalities throughout the Lower Mainland are trying to divert more waste from landfills to save space. The idea being that composting combined with recycling can divert a massive quantity of trash from landfills. The report suggests that two neighborhood pilot projects, just to test it out, followed by some fine-tuning and a possible citywide rollout as early as next year. A Japanese consortium is talking about the possibility of building a liquid natural gas plant in BC for export. Japan is looking for alternatives to nuclear energy, and they've been talking with Penn West Exploration, a Canadian company, about producing 10 million tons of shale gas, which is more than 10% of Japan's imports of liquefied natural gas. It's being reported that shale gas will be extracted from northeastern BC, then moved 1,000 kilometers via a pipeline to the coast, where the gas is going to be liquefied and exported to Japan. These facilities are expected to cost over $4 billion to extract the gas and another $12 billion for the liquefaction plant. The Japanese consortium hopes to start shipping late in the decade. If this deal goes through, it will be the first time shale gas is produced in Canada to be exported to Japan. 35 new red light cameras were installed and went live across BC on Friday. The cameras are expected to reduce the number of crashes throughout BC intersections, particularly fatal accidents, by about 6%, according to the Solicitor General. Now, it's been a busy year as far as traffic fatalities in Vancouver go. More than 10 pedestrians died in the first 6 months of this year, and that's already more than the nine deaths we saw last year. We saw an especially steep rise in pedestrian traffic deaths late last month, which prompted the Vancouver Police Department to enhance their enforcement at various intersections. So now we have about 70 cameras at high-risk intersections throughout the province, with a particularly high number of them concentrated in Vancouver's downtown east side. In 2009, SFU and UBC jointly conducted a study that identified 32 areas of risk for pedestrian injuries in Vancouver, 9 of which were on the east side. Fines will generally run about $167, which is given to BC municipalities to further policing and community public safety programs. After 168 years in circulation, a famous UK tabloid goes under. The News of World printed its final edition yesterday. Now, the paper folded due to mounting allegations of the staff's continued phone hacking. I had a little bit of problem understanding this. To fully understand exactly what happened, you need to go back to 2002. In March of that year, 13-year-old UK girl Millie Dowler went missing. Now, the News of the World covered the story and interviewed Millie's parents. In the following months, it's believed that the news got into Millie's cell phone account and accessed the missing girl's voicemail. As the voicemails filled up, staff deleted certain messages so that new ones could be left. Now, this is essentially, and I believe, the actual definition of interfering with an ongoing police investigation, and even led to some follow-up stories. And this led to some follow-up stories the paper ran based on the messages that they'd heard. 5 years later, in January of 2007, Clive Goodman, a News of the World reporter, was sentenced to jail time, along with a private investigator he'd hired, for tampering with potential evidence in an ongoing murder case. For the past couple of years, the News of the World has faced several allegations from different sources regarding this dishonest practice. And in April of this year, they actually owned up to many violations regarding voicemail interceptions between the years of 2004 and 2006. And 2.5 weeks ago, the doorman of a nightclub was found guilty in Millie Dowler's murder. Shortly afterwards, the police told Millie's family about the allegations facing News of the World regarding their daughter's investigation in the voicemail. The family quickly took legal action against the tabloid, which eventually caused the paper to shut down this weekend. I'm going to take a quick break and stay with us. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemlin.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. Know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
French Connection. Nation avec Marie-Ève Dumoulin pour tout savoir sur les activités culturelles francophones de Vancouver et ses environs, plus de la musique 100% francophone du Québec et d'ailleurs. With French Connection, you will discover everything about the French culture on CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting live from the UBC, from the Student Union Building right here on campus at UBC. I'm Martin Lemlin. You'll want to stay tuned for Sore Throat Clapping Hands. I believe Robert's got an excellent show lined up today, as he always does, but today I think is going to be especially good. Back to our headlines here. So regarding BC teachers, sorry to bring it up, but there's a new school year drawing near, and negotiations have halted for the summer between the teachers' union and BC Public Schools. And many are wondering what the impact on the kids will be, particularly those with special needs. Representatives for the Children and Youth, Mary Ellen Turbel-Lafond, told reporters yesterday that she's concerned that children with special needs are going to suffer from the Teach Only campaign, but that's being put forth by the BC Public School teachers. Now, the Teachers Federation announced last month that it's going to take job action in the form of striking on their duties which don't include teaching. Now, should teachers and schools fail to reach a collective agreement on September 6th, teachers have said that they're not going to do any administrative meetings or fill out paper report cards, and they're just going to teach, nothing more. Turbel-Lafond says that it's important that teachers make an exception and attend meetings for those with special needs so that they'll know what those needs are and how to accommodate the students in the classroom. Jim Eicher, who is the vice president of the BC Teachers Federation, responded almost immediately that the meetings regarding special needs students, individualized education plans, they're known as IEPs, they're going to take place this fall with or without the participation of school administration. So the Teachers Federation will be meeting with representatives to discuss the matter further in the month of August. The deadline for casting your HSD ballot is quickly approaching. Some BC residents haven't received their ballots, while others have, and then some. Many households throughout BC are receiving voting packages for people they've never heard of, and some that they have. Reports of a White Rock resident claim that he got one ballot for his mother-in-law, who died about 4 years ago, as well as the people who he bought his home from 9 years ago. Even at my place, we've received no less than six ballots, and none of them are for myself. All but one are for people who don't even live there. The main concern here is how easy it would be to mail in a fraudulent vote. All it would take is an accurate birthday and a forged signature. Please don't do this. It wouldn't help the democratic process, and it's certainly an orthodox way to hold a referendum, but it's the way it's going to be, so we'll have to do it as honestly as we can. If you haven't received a ballot yet, you have until July 22nd, 11 days from today, to call Elections BC and ask for one. That number, I'm going to say it again, is 1-800-661-8683. The world has started taking notice of a Kenyan refugee camp. Nearly 400,000 refugees are now living in Dadaab, the largest camp in Kenya, with tens of thousands arriving on a daily basis. Now, most are from Somalia, a country that's been devastated by drought that has lasted years and years. Families are forced to abandon their homes and farms, walking for days, in some cases weeks, in an effort to find the refugee camp. But resources are running low in Dadaab, and Dadaab isn't equipped to handle such high volume. And many, mostly children, are dying because of it. Over half of the children are malnourished, and although the camp is able to treat severe cases, they're almost certain to come back underfed because of a general lack of food, and almost all the children are suffering from diarrhea. Al-Shabaab, Somalia's reigning militant group, has forced out all international aid. With no food available, residents of Somalia, Ethiopia, as well as Kenya, were forced to seek out Dadaab and others like it. International relief efforts are essentially the only source of food that they have. Earlier this month, the Al-Shabaab militants said that aid groups could return to Somalia as conditions became more and more desperate, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be enough. The head of the UN Refugee Agency is calling Somalia the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. He and relief workers are pleading for resources in the hope of curbing the deaths which are taking place, almost all of which are children. There's a nasty little virus hitting southern Ontario. It's being called C. difficile, and basically it gets passed along through through contact. It's already in most hospitals, but it strikes most in people who are elderly, already ill, or taking antibiotics. C. difficile usually causes bouts of biblical diarrhea, and the bacteria stays in the diarrhea and can be passed along through the toilet if they aren't thoroughly cleaned. And although it looked like almost every hospital is plagued by C. difficile to some extent, in this recent case, over 20 people have died in southern Ontario, mostly St. Catharines, Welland, and the Niagara region. But hospitals are being affected. The hospitals being affected are becoming less and less. The Ontario Health Minister announced yesterday that hospitals affected by the outbreak have gone down from 10 to 7. Basically, it can be rendered useless with proper hand-washing techniques, and most of the people that have died were either incredibly ill or were elderly. And U.S. President Barack Obama met last night with congressional leaders to try and hash out a plan regarding the country's debt. Democrats and Republicans are trying to reach a deal on raising the United States debt ceiling by August 2nd, that being the date the country will technically default on their deficit. A debt ceiling is a cap on the amount of money that a government can borrow. Now, the U.S. spends such a massive amount of money, and it has gotten used to borrowing such a vast quantities that it's estimated they borrow about 40 cents for every dollar they spend. If the two political sides aren't able to raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd, the United States will default on its loans as of that day, which could cause financial turmoil in the country and, at the very least, seriously hamper its economic recovery. The latest offering has been an attempt to pursue a $4 trillion 10-year deficit reduction package, but they had to abandon it Saturday because, in the face of GOP opposition to any plan that would increase taxes. To further look into the U.S. financial crisis and to curb their spending, they had to cut military aid to Pakistan. We're going to throw things back to FSRN, who did an outstanding report regarding this.
The U.S. is suspending $800 million worth of aid to Pakistan, or about a third of total U.S. military aid to the country. The cut was reported over the weekend in the New York Times and confirmed by White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley yesterday during an interview on ABC TV. The reduction comes as the outgoing head of the International Red Cross today said that since the death of Osama bin Laden, there's been an intensification of fighting and violence in Pakistan. For a Pakistani reaction to the U.S. suspension of military aid, we go to Rafia Zakaria, a columnist for Pakistan's English-language daily newspaper, Dawn. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Well, thank you for having me.
Where do you see this military funding cut in the wider picture of years of difficult U.S.-Pakistan relations?
I think this latest episode comes at obviously a particularly tense time in Pakistan-American relations. I don't think a lot of people around the world, especially Americans, realize that in the aftermath of the raid on Osama bin Laden, there has been a quite rapid unraveling of the political and the security situation in that country. And given that backdrop, this cut in aid is not only going to make that relationship even more suspicious than it's been in the past few days. In the Pakistani media, and in Pakistan in general, there's increasing anti-Americanism to the point that now, you know, even very liberal, secular forces are, I would say, rabidly anti-American. So given this cut in aid, I mean, you would see, if you saw Pakistani media, the incredible political dividends that are out there for anybody, any politician in Pakistan, to say that we are intentionally refusing American aid instead of saying that the Americans are unilaterally cutting aid. That is a ticket to popularity in that country. If you oppose the U.S., if you oppose American aid, if you oppose drone attacks, you are immediately heroicized.
So it sounds like this cut in aid, rather than act as some sort of pressure on the Pakistan military, probably won't have that effect at all.
At least that's, you know, that's the impression that that they're trying to give. You know, in the past few weeks, the Pakistani military, I mean, you've seen kind of what I would describe as a sort of a media war going on between various American officials and the Pakistani military, where, you know, Mike Mullen accused the ISI of being involved in the murder of a journalist. You know, the ISR, the ISPR, a military spokesperson in Pakistan, responded by saying that this is a direct attack on the military, and that continues with this new news of the cut in aid. Is you know, the Pakistani military, which is, I would say, kind of out of character for them, has started to take very public positions in saying that we don't need this aid. The aid numbers are inflated anyway. The U.S. really hasn't given us that much, and we're going to be fine without it. And of course, that's being received very, very well, very positively in Pakistan.
What can you tell us about Pakistan's other military allies? How important, for example, is China becoming to Pakistan, and how is that relationship viewed by Pakistanis?
Well, I mean, in recent months, especially since the May 2nd raid, Pakistanis have at least, you know, seemingly tried very hard to hedge their bets against the United States. So the, you know, the president went to China. There's been a sort of a very kind of pronounced drive to show that China is an available and ready option as an ally to replace the American position that, you know, American position in Pakistan. So there's been a lot of talk about that. The details, of course, are sketchy because it's unknown how much of that aid will come and how that replacement will work. But the effort, at least on the Pakistani side, is really to show the U.S. is that, okay, fine. I mean, if you want to take your money and go ahead and take your money and go, and we're going to find other people to help us. You know, the other issue, I think, here is the issue of American trainers in Pakistan, which is ostensibly the reason why the U.S. is saying that they're cutting aid. I mean, that is an issue that there's just incredible public sentiment against. I mean, Pakistanis do not want American military officials in their country, and so you know that, and they see it as an ongoing further incursion on their sovereignty after the drone attacks, after the Osama bin Laden raid. So you know, it looks at this point that they're willing to give up that aid. You know, and if you ask ordinary people in Pakistan, they'll say, "Well, we never saw any of that aid in the first place. You know, it's definitely not trickling down to us." And so, you know, if they want to cut aid, go ahead, cut aid, and, you know, maybe we'll be rid of the whole American presence altogether.
You mentioned the U.S. drone program, and that's deeply unpopular in Pakistan. How do you see this playing into that issue?
The drone issue is at the heart of all of this. It's the core of all this. Pakistanis see those drone attacks as an incursion on their territory. In addition to that, the drone attacks have created problems for a lot of Pakistanis that live very far away from the tribal areas. The displacement of millions of Pashtuns into urban areas has, as you might have seen in recent weeks, unleashed ethnic riots in cities like Karachi. So this is a huge mess, and at least within the Pakistani political psyche, it's a mess that's pinned singularly onto the United States.
Rafia Zakaria, columnist for Pakistan's daily English-language newspaper, Dawn, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to FSRN for that. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. You're listening to CITR News 101 on 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here on campus at UBC.
For 7 days in July, Vancouver will play host to another international gathering of sports enthusiasts as we host the North American Out Games. The Out Games will feature 18 different sports, from badminton to poker to hockey, The Games will also include the Human Rights Conference, with workshops on diversity and an awards ceremony recognising individuals and corporations that have influenced LGBTQ rights. Scheduled events during the week-long Games include a job fair, the Miss Gay and Lesbian Sports Association pageant, cultural activities, and the most amazing closing ceremonies you've ever laid witness to. The event will come to a close with a march of athletes in the world-famous 2011 Vancouver Pride Parade. Catch all the festivities, events and parties at www.vancouver2011outgames.com. Listen to our live broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, or check out our live stream at www.citr.ca and www.queerfmvancouver.com.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts downtown at 212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, Heart and Soul Clothing Incorporated, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Scratch Records, True Value Vintage, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca. Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. And it's now time for our weekday weather forecast with Jesse Storm. Jesse, how are you?
I'm well, Martin. How are you doing?
Pretty excellent. Pretty excellent. Right. I'm hoping for a little more sunlight, though. Can you help me out, baby?
I can try. Well, it is pretty nice today, even though we have the cloud cover. We're looking at a high of 21 and a low of 14 later today. The clouds are going to stick around. The sun won't come out to play, but that's all right. Tomorrow we're going to have some rain come in, unfortunately. We're going to go down to a low of 13, but luckily a high of 20. And Wednesday, again, the rain. No, not going to see any sun probably until later in the week on Thursday. Wednesday it'll be probably about 17 and Thursday 16.
That sounds decent.
It does sound decent, actually. It's not too bad, especially with the warmer weather today. I wouldn't mind cooling down a little bit. You know, it's getting a little bit humid. So the rain will bring in a nice little change. It'll make it a little crisper in the air, I think.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jess. We'll talk to you in about 15 minutes.
All right, Martin. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. That was our weekday weather forecast. Not great news, but not horrible either. Let's get back to the hard news here. How would you feel about having your internet content regulated by the CRTC? The Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission is considering reopening the discussion of setting rules for online broadcasters. Now, the CRTC ended a fact-finding mission last week and is looking at public consultation for what they call over-the-top services, which they describe as things like YouTube and streaming. Now, the broadcast regulators describe over-the-top services as anything on the internet that isn't general web surfing or email. In 2009, they decided that these services didn't need to be regulated, but they'd reopen the debate in 2013 once the internet had time to develop a little more. But the debate is being reopened today as to whether internet providers should be allowed unlimited internet billing as well. Companies like Rogers and Bell argue that heavy internet users are causing congestion during peak hours and that they should pay accordingly, while certain government officials question whether these heavy users are actually the ones causing the congestions. To complicate matters, the CRTC is also looking into imposing regulations on YouTube and Google, essentially limiting the content these services provide you. broadcasters from other media are complaining that it's unfair to allow internet services a free ride without imposing rules such as CanCon, which forces a certain percentage of Canadian content on broadcasters operating in our country. In any case, it's likely to be a slow process. We're still learning how to implement all of these new technological changes into our lives. An expert strongly suggests that the best way to handle this new market is just to allow the internet and all of its services the time to figure itself out. The CTV News has lost one of its best, but it's nothing compared to the destructive ideology pilfering its inner ranks. Kai Nagata, a 24-year-old reporter and former Quebec bureau chief for CTV News, quit his post last Thursday. This weekend, he posted an article online that outlined his reasons for leaving, and he didn't have a falling out with a colleague. He had no problem with high demands or pressure of the fast-paced job. In his post, titled "Why I Quit My Job," Kai describes how he became disillusioned with television news and a growing tension between what people want to see and what a responsible newsman should be reporting, a world where profit trumps important news, where journalists are forced to give up their opinions, beliefs, and even their intellectual property. At the young age of 23, Nagata found himself in the seemingly enviable position of being CTV News Bureau's chief in Quebec. But now, less than a year later, he turned his back on the private broadcaster, and it seemed like Nagata has seen enough of big-time newsmaking and broadcasting in this country, and he wants out. In Kai's opinion, the illness isn't isolated to CTV. He proposes CBC, our public broadcaster, is also in the race to the bottom. Culminating in this summer's royal tour, when he quotes, "When real news was happening in Bangkok, Misrata, Athens, Washington, and around the world," Nagata writes, "what we saw instead was a breathless gaggle of normally credible journalists gushing about how the prince is young and his wife is pretty. And the public broadcaster CBC led this charge." Nagata's review of the state of North American broadcast news is not insightful and uncharacteristically principled. The full blog entry can be found at Kai Nagata, that's spelled KaiNagata.com. If you have an interest in information you consume and who chooses the content and why, I strongly suggest you look it up. I'm going to take another quick little break, but stay with us. Listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. Now we're going to give things back to FSRN because they seem so capable. Because as Congress inches closer to passing the free trade agreements with South Korea and Panama and Colombia, there were some activists that opposed the agreements and are gearing up for a fight. FSRN tells you more.
As Congress inches closer to passing free trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia, activists opposed to the agreements are gearing up for a fight. Hundreds gathered outside the White House on Monday to protest the Colombia free trade agreement, which they say will kill jobs here and threaten communities in Colombia. Alice Olstein reports.
Faith leaders, students, environmentalists, human rights activists, and workers from U.S. and Colombian unions gathered outside the White House Monday afternoon to call on President Obama and Congress to block the pending free trade agreement, or FTA, with Colombia. The marchers carried 51 black coffins to represent the 51 unionists killed in Colombia in 2010, and signs in English and Spanish calling for fair trade, not free trade. The Service Employees International Union brought several unionists from Colombia to speak at the rally. Sugarcane worker and Afro-Colombian labor organizer Juan Cambindo told the crowd why he is fighting against the FTA's passage.
They've only taken the needs of the multinationals, the business community, into account. As for us, the workers, we'll be miserably displaced, and they'll take no social responsibility for us. All in all, it's a death sentence. We are completely in opposition to the agreement they're going to sign.
The activists have some support in Congress. During a recent Senate committee hearing on the FTAs, Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin read from the State Department's 2010 report on human rights in Colombia.
Unlawful and extrajudicial killings, insubordinate military collaboration, new illegal armed groups, forced disappearance, torture, and mistreatment of detainees, arbitrary detentions, impunity, and an inefficient judiciary subject to intimidation, illegal surveillance of civilian groups, occasional harassment and intimidation of journalists, harassment of human rights groups and activists, violence against women, including rape, societal discrimination against women, indigenous persons, and Afro-Colombians, illegal child labor, and the list goes on and on and on. That's the 2010 report.
Cardin said the U.S. should withhold the agreement to leverage human rights demands on Colombia. But nearly all the other senators on the committee praised the FTAs, like Montana Democrat Max Baucus, the committee's chairman.
The free trade agreements will improve American competitiveness and create jobs. They'll open foreign markets, increase U.S. exports, and grow our economy. It is time to act.
The Colombia FTA is nearly identical to the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. The agreement would eliminate tariffs on some U.S. goods entering Colombia immediately and phase out others over time. It would also prevent governments from regulating the hiring, sourcing, and environmental practices of foreign corporations. And it would empower companies to sue governments in international tribunals for loss of profit, like the Pacific Rim Mining Corporation is currently doing under CAFTA, after the government of El Salvador refused to issue a permit for its gold mining operations. The agreement also prohibits price controls on staple foods in Colombia, like corn, leaving consumers vulnerable to an unstable market. Here in the U.S., the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates that the Colombia FTA will result in nearly $3 billion lost in federal revenue over 10 years, even with increased exports. While Democrats and Republicans alike are pushing for the FTA's passage, the parties split on the inclusion of Trade Adjustment Assistance, or TAA, which would help workers whose jobs are offshored under the agreements. President Obama has insisted that TAA be included in the trade agreements, but Republicans, like Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, are firmly opposed.
I cannot condone this abuse of trade promotion authority or turn a blind eye to dubious domestic spending programs.
Democrats, like Senator John Kerry, accused Republicans of posturing and defended the TAA.
We're making a policy here, and as a result of that policy, we know some people are going to be thrown out of work.
Hello, if you don't like the government program that requires government money to help people who lose jobs to bad trade agreements, then the other answer is don't pass more bad NAFTA-style job-killing trade agreements.
Former trade attorney Lori Wallach is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch Division. She supports the movement protesting the Colombia FTA, but says activists need to fight all three agreements.
When you take them together, you have the Korea trade agreement that's going to kill tens of thousands of jobs, the Colombia disgrace agreement with the world's leading assassinator of unionists and a human rights scourge, and you have the Panama Agreement, an agreement with a large tax haven, of which there is no upside economically and lots of financial crime we would no longer be able to penalize.
Since the agreements were signed by President Bush under the fast-track rules, Congress can only request changes to the FTAs. When the White House sends the final versions to the Hill, which could happen this week, it'll be for straight up or down votes with no amendments. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us that insight. It's now time to revert back to our my little personal life preserver, Jesse Storm. How's it going, Jesse?
It's going well, Martin. How are you? Are you surviving?
I'm doing pretty well.
That's good.
You've been doing some fairly extensive research regarding Vancouver's Gay Pride Parade, haven't you?
That's true. There's actually some discussion being done as of late because of some issues they've been having. Vancouver takes its pride serious, and in 2010, the city was rocked by 640,000 parade goers, making its 33rd year anniversary its biggest yet. keeping its place as not only the second largest parade in Western Canada, but also the second largest event on Vancouver's calendar year. And it's for that reason exactly that organizers are asking for a break on fees for the upcoming celebration. On average, the nonprofit event spends almost $750,000 of their hard-by sponsors' money to make the event happen, and over 58,000 of that goes to the city for transit, sanitation, policing, among other things. So, in short, Martin, they're asking to get a break on some of these fees, if you can believe that. Sanitation and policing really should come down to the city's responsibility.
And these are fees for taking up the streets, I guess. It costs money to close the streets down?
Right. And they understand that, of course, they're going to have to pay for their transit and their permitting, which is only, you know, respectable. But at the same time, with the policing and the sanitation, it being the second largest and bringing in over 640,000 parade goers, you know, it creates tourism, it creates money for the whole city. So they think that really they should just get a bit of that back, essentially.
You have any idea how much... how much money it's going to cost to put the thing on? Probably none.
Oh, yeah, no. 700 in total to put the entire event on, it's approximately $750,000 each year.
A year? And it's been going on for 33 years, you said, right?
That's correct, Martin. Actually, it's for the Pride Parade itself, it's about $68,000. The festival and the events is $75,000, so that's the stage, tent, speakers and such. Communications, so media, websites and graphics, and is $250,000 of that actual budget. So, yeah. So you know, it takes a lot to put the parade on. They put it on for good reasons, and it's a great, great event every year. There's not usually much problems with the event or the event goers. But, you know, for the tourism and the part that they play for the city, which is rightly justified, that they believe that they should get a cut on the fees that they have to pay and incur every year.
You'll have to forgive my ignorance. I'm new to town. When does this happen?
This actually happens in August.
In August? All right, so it's coming up. It's coming up.
Yeah, it is coming up. It is coming up, and it should be a great event again this year. But you know,
is there
only time can tell. They are stating that apparently if they do this and go through with it and pay and incur those fees, they're either going to have to drop some other things within the city, or ultimately we'd have to increase taxes again.
Quite again, nice. Have the prices gone up since last year? Did they lose sponsors or something?
No, but as any year, it's just harder to get the sponsorship. You know, and they have to go out there and get these people to sponsor them for it. And sometimes, especially with the recession happening in 2008 and the economy has been like since, you know, we're just getting all back onto our feet, you know. So hopefully this will better things, but still, they still put on the event and they still bring in the tourism and the money for the businesses.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be a party regardless of who ends up footing the bill.
Yeah. Quite the party, actually. Have you ever been to one?
Yes, I have. I had a job picking up trash at the Pride Parade in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was quite a good time.
It's always a great time, and you really feel at home. You don't ever feel scared. I never did ever any events that I've ever gone to. So it's a family event. I think it deserves a break.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Not a problem, Martin.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
That was Jesse Storm. Quickly becoming our chief correspondent of downtown affairs, we'll call it, as well as our very capable weather girl here. I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break, but I have one last little bit of sad news here. A Vancouver Island animal refuge was the victim of a truly senseless attack last month. Susan Vickery, who runs a Ears Animal Sanctuary near Nanaimo, and it houses about 600 rabbits, mostly of which come from the University of Victoria. Now, when Vickery walked into the sanctuary on the morning of June 15th, she saw a rabbit laying dead outside of the pen. And then another inside the pen. And then another, and another. And it went on like this until she counted 20 dead rabbits. The cause of the death? Quite simply, a boot. It would seem that someone went into the pen and started stomping on bunny rabbits until 20 were crushed. Now, Vickery believes that this was the work of a single person due to the tracks that they left behind. And she said she waited so long to go public because she wanted time to install better security measures. Now, this is truly a pretty horrible act, and senseless to say the least. On an unrelated note, I have to say that Jericho Park right now is absolutely overrun with adorable little bunny rabbits. If you have the time, I suggest you go check it out, and please, please, don't step on any of them.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot in saloon?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, you remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate, he fiddled well.
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Rush Show on CITR.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. We're going to have Sore Throats Clapping Hands coming up with Robert Privet in a short 9 minutes. But first, we're going to take news on the lighter side, because I guess the Grammys are cutting their fundings, and with it a few categories, and musicians aren't really happy about this. I suppose they're even going so far as to decry the cuts as being racist and short-sighted. Now, Rebecca Miles from FSRN is going to tell us a little bit about it here.
The organizers of the Grammy Awards recently announced that they're cutting dozens of categories from their music awards program. The move has angered musicians who say the decision is racist and short-sighted. Rebecca Miles in New York has more.
Carlos Santana, Eddie Palmieri, Paul Simon, Herbie Hancock, and other musicians across the country are speaking out over changes to the Grammy Awards, the country's most prestigious and only peer-recognized award in music. In an email sent to its 21,000 members in April, the National Academy of Recording Artists and Sciences said they're reducing the number of award categories from 109 to 78. Bobby Sanabria, a multi-nominated Grammy musician in the Latin jazz category, said they started doing the math and realized that over 70% of the categories cut were racially and ethnically based.
We believe that they did this for three reasons. One, to save money. They save about $500,000 to $1 million by cutting these categories. Two, by cutting the categories, effectively they've cut the power of independent record labels. These record labels are all mom-and-pop labels, most of them. Some of the labels are owned and run by the artists themselves. And third, there's obviously the racial aspect to it. As I said before, over 70% of the categories are ethnically and racially based.
Sanabria says he's particularly shocked about one category the Academy cut.
The blues, which is the parent category or the mother of all forms of American popular music, without the blues, we don't have anything. The blues have been cut out, both the traditional and contemporary categories of blues. The traditional and contemporary categories of gospel have been cut out. Zydeco has been cut out, Cajun has been cut out, Hawaiian music, polka music, goes on and on and on. So somebody has to stand up and say something.
The National Academy of Recording Artists and Sciences didn't respond to interview requests, but in a statement said they, quote, spent 2 years researching and making the decision, and it had nothing to do with ethnicity or race. Roger Maldonado, a partner with the law firm Balber Pickett Maldonado, said it's hard to understand why the Academy took this decision, as it was a fairly secretive process.
Bobby Sanabria and other Latin jazz musicians have retained my firm to bring a challenge against the determination to eliminate the Latin jazz category. We will be filing that complaint within, you know, the next couple of weeks, and we will be inviting musicians who are representatives of other categories that were cut to bring similar lawsuits either here in New York or in states and cities where they reside.
Maldonado said the lawsuit's main goal is to reinstate the categories. Several performers have announced their support for a campaign to reinstate the eliminated categories through a website petition, GrammyWatch.org. Rebecca Miles, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
Thank you very much for that, FSRN and Rebecca Miles. And that is going to do it for our show today on July 11th, 2011. Thank you very much for listening to us. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. Nobody is getting paid here, I assure you that. If you'd like to get in touch with us, either to give us a hot news tip, make a comment, or even contribute, you can get in touch with us at news at CITR.ca, or you can phone us at 604-822-5334. Be sure to follow us on Twitter under the username CITR News. For all of us here at CITR, thanks for listening. And stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands. It's coming up right now in about 4 minutes with Robert Privet. Enjoy it. I'm Martin Lumlin. Have a good night.